According to a University of Minnesota survey, 75% of people trust farmers, but only 24% trust food. That leads us to ask, why do so many people trust farmers, but so few trust food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1383rd edition of the Food Chain Radio Show and podcast. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Quebec City who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, 74% of us trust farmers, but only 24% trust food. Why do we trust farmers? Well, Thomas Jefferson may have said it best. Those who labor in the earth are the chosen people of God, if ever he had a chosen people, whose breasts he has made his peculiar deposit for substantial and genuine virtue. It is the focus in which he keeps alive that sacred fire, which otherwise might escape from the face of the earth. Wow. Well, so why do we not trust food? If we trust farmers the way we do, consider what farm worker organizer Cesar Chavez has said. Pesticides soak the fields, drift with the wind, pollute the water, and are eaten by unwitting consumers. These poisons are designed to kill and pose a very real threat to consumers and farm workers alike. A while back, the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance hosted a farm and food panel discussion at the International Biotech Conference at Chicago's McCormick Place. Real big, huge, giant place, as a matter of fact. I was invited to sit on that panel with some very important people in production agriculture, including the president of the American Corn Growers Association, president of the American Soybean Growers Association, and president of the American Pork Producers. I'm not certain why I was invited to speak, but suspect it was for the same reason put hot sauce in clam chowder. At any rate, the panel's discussion focused on the benefits of biotech to production agriculture. Make no mistake, the benefits are huge. Having been a teenage herbicide and weeded countless rows of crops under the blazing summer sun of Montana's Yellowstone River Valley, I knew firsthand how blessed today's farmers are with new biotech control tools. And yet, when it came time to deliver my closing remarks, I pulled out the hot sauce and addressed the biotechies seated in the audience. You have created a miracle, I told them. One farmer may now grow 10,000 acres of crops without having to compete with weed or insect pests. You have made these farmers on the panel with me very happy, and you have made yourself very wealthy. But one day the people who eat your crops are going to come to you and say, hey, what's in this technology for us other than food that has been drenched in herbicides and infused with pesticides? When that day comes, you're going to need an answer. So I suggest you come up with that answer as soon as possible. And that leads us to today's question. Why do most people trust farmers, but so few trust food? Today, we are most grateful to have a farmer who is willing to step forward with answers. He is Dennis Boulani, who is a fourth-generation farmer, the CEO of the Rack Petroleum up there in Saskatchewan, and the author of About Food, What a Farmer Wants You to Know. Dennis, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hi, pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to have you from Saskatchewan. Farms in Saskatchewan? Wow, tell us about your farm in Saskatchewan.
So my farm is in central Saskatchewan. It's located north of Bigger. The town is called Bigger, Saskatchewan. The sign actually says, New York is big, but this is bigger.
Pretty good.
So, so my farm is a small farm relative to all the farms in the area, but I farm about 1,000 acres of grain land, and I grow anything from faba beans, lentils, peas, canola, rye, fall rye, are the primary crop, sometimes barley. And that kind of fits our environment here, those crops. So that's what I grow.
Well, I was kind of, as we were talking about, I was raised on a farm near Belfry, Montana, that had 360 irrigated acres. Your acres are not irrigated, are they?
No. Actually, I do have one quarter section pivot. I'm a real inquisitive person, and my background is actually in nutrition, animal nutrition, to be honest with you. And when I started farming, I became very intrigued with the nutrition of field crops. And I had the opportunity to actually build one quarter section pivot about 5 years ago. And it's kind of my little experimentation plot, but I do have one quarter section center pivot.
And the rest of it, dry farmed.
Yes.
How does
some
that
years
work?
Very dry.
That's right.
Some years very dry.
Yeah, would you tell the audience how dry farming works? Of course, that's a lot of what we did in Montana, and you see these checkerboard patterns across the landscape. Is that the way you do it as well?
Yes, that's correct. We've certainly changed. I've been farming 41 years now, and when I first started farming, we were using, I would say, old technology, and because of sustainability practices, we've actually learned now, we're probably the first in the world to convert our farming methods to what's called direct seeding, where we don't disturb the soil.
And so instead of running over the soil with a moldboard plow and turning it over and exposing it to the elements, you don't. You just seed directly into the ground.
Yeah, that's correct. The goal is to have as little soil disturbance as possible. And through research and stuff, we've learned that when we till the soil in this area, we actually can harm the sustainability of it.
So instead of having those checkerboard patterns of a crop in one checkerboard and the next one will have bare soil, you don't have the bare soil anymore.
That's right. Approximately probably 95 or even almost 100% of the land in Western Canada is direct seeded. So if you fly over, you'll see different colors. You'll never rarely see black, which is exposed soil.
Which is a good thing.
That's a very good thing.
Because,
we've determined that number one, if we're going to be sustainable and pass on the resource, our topsoil, most of our topsoil in Western Canada is about 6 inches. And if we till it, the wind blows it away. And that 6 inches, isn't very much. So that's number one in our minds when we farm.
Well, we're really fortunate to have somebody who is smart enough to figure this one out, that if you plow up the soil, it blows away. And that happened in the 1920s here in the United States. A lot of our topsoil simply, we plowed up the prairies and it blew away.
Yeah, and that's correct. Back then we didn't have the technology, and primarily we plowed our soil to control weeds. We didn't know back then, our grandfathers, they farmed the best they could, and they thought that tilling the soil was how you did it, because they had learned from their European ancestors. As time went along, probably the biggest ecological disaster in North America was what they call the Dirty 30s. Everybody was tilling the soil back then, and of course it turned dry in North America, very dry, and with high winds, the first thing to blow away is the most valuable component of the topsoil, the organic matter in clay. So we lost quite a bit of the resource in the 30s. And that, of course, made us recognize that we were doing it wrong, and so we had to change our methods.
And we did. And thus,
and we did.
Thus we learned how to seed seeds directly into the soil.
That's correct. And I actually had the opportunity in my career to live through that transition from what they called summer fallow, which is tilling the soil black, to the transition to direct seeding. And, you know, with change comes a lot of questions, and a lot of farmers were somewhat resistant to changing their old habits. But lo and behold, everybody did, because they recognized we were actually growing more food, protecting the soil, and actually protecting the water as well.
But as one of the first, did you find some reluctance in your neighbors who would look over the imaginary fence, I'm sure, and say, Dennis, what the heck are you doing?
Oh, yes. My father in particular, he said, like, I took over the farm from my dad in 1981, and he said, what the heck are you doing? You got to give the land a rest. You can't crop every year. You have to let it rest. And I said, well, in Mother Nature, it never rests. It grows plants every year. So in my mind, that's probably a more natural process. And we need to understand what nature's doing, growing crops every year, whether we're there or not. And so that was kind of the light bulb that made us think about other ways to do things.
And that process has probably been going on since day one of humanity. Father says to son, you can't do it that way. And son says to father, let's try it. And sometimes it works. And it worked for you.
Yeah, and I think that's what I love about human ingenuity. We're always trying to do one thing better. And even that continues today, that evolution, you know, as agriculture, food production has evolved, that was one of the steps. And now we got to that point, and now with new technology, actually with DNA, now with the discovery of the way to test soil, like test for DNA, we actually now in agriculture, we actually test our soil for the DNA in the soil. We can test for every living organism in the soil, and now use that as a rating system to understand how our processes affect and impact living bugs in the soil. It's pretty cool.
And thus you bring technology really to the fore here. When you have 1,000 acres, you pretty much have to farm with technology, with modern technology. Is that not true?
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, like when you spill popcorn on the floor in your living room, is it easier to pick them up one at a time or use a vacuum cleaner? So, yeah, when you farm 1,000 acres, you need a vacuum cleaner for that type of thing.
Well, I've interviewed a lot of farmers who operate on very big parcels of land, and they all rely on the technologies of modern times to do it when it gets right down to it. And you'll be one of them. Well, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'd like to ask you, to start off with here, is if food is trustworthy, why do so few people trust food? Ladies and gentlemen, you're tuned into the Food Chain Radio Program, number 1383. And the title of this one is A Farmer Defends Foods with Dennis Bulani, who is a farmer and a business person up there in Beggar, Saskatchewan, which is way up north. So when we come back, we're going to talk about why we, city people, don't trust our food. Do stay tuned. We will be right back after these very important messages.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Dennis Bulani, a successful farmer and businessman way up there in Beggar, Saskatchewan. Dennis, as a successful farmer and businessman, do you remember the moment when the apple fell on your head and you decided, oh, I simply must write this book about food?
Oh, yeah, I certainly do. I guess the times evolved over my farming career, and more of even my relatives were asking hard questions about, well, why do you spray chemicals on the food we have to eat, and how, you know, they had questions about it. And as time went on, I always want to be right when I answer a question. I never always had all the exact scientific research or detail available to be able to answer the question. And it always pondered me when it came about, and sometimes it was argumentative. As a farmer, rather than get in an argument, I probably changed the conversation. And I felt guilty about that. I mean, I'm very proud to be a farmer. And yet, if I'm proud to be a farmer, why didn't I address the issue? So I was at a conference about a year ago, and one of the guest speakers got up. He'd probably never been to a farm, and he basically demonized everything I was doing. And I thought to myself, you know what? People are hearing messages, but they're not hearing the farmer's message. And I think it's high time I step up and tell people that are so busy. You know, people are so busy and farming's so complicated, they don't always have the time to understand it. But only 2% in North America is farmers. So 98% of the messaging coming is from not farmers. And as a result, our message is not getting out. And I thought, well, it's time, how to eat an elephant one teaspoon at a time, that I compile all the information, all the research I've done over 40 years into one book with references that would address some of these questions. And they're all good questions.
And they're good questions simply because we city people don't know. I was thinking as I looked into your book and the question, when we city people think of farms, we think of the farms we go to pick apples or buy some vegetables directly from the farmer, and we see this bucolic little farm where people are digging in the soil and whatnot. But we haven't seen your farm. And when we do see it, it's generally from an airplane flying over at 37,000 feet. And so we simply do not know. And
that's right.
And when we do not know, and we see what we see and read what we read in the press, we become very frightened. Oh, my goodness. And when it gets right down to it, what we see and read and hear about in the press tends to be really frightening stuff because, that, of course, is what captures people's attention. When you say everything is just right, people go, well, I'm not paying attention. But when you say there's poison in your food, people pay attention. So that's what you're up against, right?
Yes, that's correct. And then those are valid questions. Those are very valid questions. Now, you talked about the bucolic scene of a farmer out in the back 40 with a pitchfork and probably wearing coveralls. Right? It's interesting. If you go into AI and say, show me a picture of a farmer, 90% of the time it'll come up with a guy in coveralls with a pitchfork. And that, I don't know how that got about, but most farmers are business people and they're professionals and they take their careers very seriously and they do a lot of research. And that's what's changed. And also what's changed is, everything in society has been consolidating due to economies of scale. The interesting thing is 88 or 90% of all the farms in North America are still family farms that have been passed on from generation to generation. And they've all gotten a little bigger as a result of consolidation. So it's pretty cool to know that the ethics that my father had about taking care of the soil as best he could, and now myself, the number one thing on a farmer's mind is I need to take care of my soil so I can pass it on to future generations and protect it for the world, for the food supply. So, you know, you asked me when the light bulb came on. One of the times the light bulb came on is I was talking to a lady in Toronto from downtown Toronto, and she was telling me about how when she went shopping, she actually hated going to the grocery store. She said, "I can't stand going to the grocery store. I have to have my iPhone there, and I have to look at every label. I'm scared I'm going to poison my children." She has two kids. I said, I just can't imagine the fear of that. And I said, like, for me, my wife doesn't let me go grocery shopping because I'm like a kid in a candy store. I know from the research I've done how safe the food is. So for me, it's kind of a heyday heaven to go into a grocery store. And I don't worry about those things because I understand where it came from and how it was grown. And it's really sad that our consumers have this fear to go buying food. And I thought, you know, if I write a book, What a Farmer Wants You to Know About Food, the most important thing is it's safe. The food in the grocery stores today has never been actually safer because of all the technology we've used and how we're able to understand how these things work in a scientific system.
Okay. Well, to me, it's obvious that food is safe. Otherwise, we'd probably all be dead. So we're running around to go to the grocery store buying stuff, some of which probably isn't all that good to eat anyway, but we eat it, and even the stuff that is not good to eat is relatively safe. But if food is safe, why are we so frightened? What makes us so frightened?
Well, I think by and large, what makes us frightened has been 98% of the messaging out there is people that use fear to probably sell something, and then some of that came from people trying to sell maybe supplements and diets that are strange. And the best way to sell a diet is to create a demon. And if they demonize commercial production, then maybe you'll buy their stuff. And so there's this undertone of people trying to use negative connotation to sell their side of it. And that's part of it. But the other part of it is, by and large, it's so complicated and people are so busy, they don't actually have time to delve into the scientific questions that go into growing the food. And if they did, which is what my book addresses, they would understand that there's a reason for everything because it's been so well researched to ensure that it is safe.
I think, you know, in the work that I have done over the years, I think it kind of boils down to distance that makes us city people so frightened. We just don't know. And with respect to economies of scale that you brought up, when it gets right down to it, as the bigger you grow, the more you have to find those economies of scale. For example, if you have 1,000 acres, then buying a combine for $100,000 isn't so expensive because you have 1,000 acres to spread the costs over. But if you have 1 acre, that $100,000 combine is way too expensive to buy. So as farms grow larger and larger and larger, the more they have to rely on these technologies and the more they benefit by the economies of scale. What do you think?
That's correct. And actually, these technologies, large combines, which now are over $1 million for one new combine, $1 million for a combine. So to justify the combine, yeah, you need more acres to cover with that combine. And by the way, that combine is capable of handling more acres. So that allows the farmer to get a little larger. But some consumers think, well, just because you're getting larger doesn't mean you gave up your family values. And, you know, 90% of the farms are family farms. So are they getting bigger? Yes. Is big farming bad? Not necessarily. It always amazes me some consumers that maybe own a house and maybe three other rental properties can get bigger and and make more money by doing that. But it seems to be taboo for a farmer to get bigger. And we're getting bigger, and we're actually getting more efficient. Is it, you know, in the old days, let me use a dairy farm as an example. In the old days, when dairy farms were 20 to 40 cows, you know, they were probably not that efficient and probably didn't understand how to keep milk safe. And usually in Mother Nature, all farmers are usually battling Mother Nature. So in the old days, if a cow had mastitis, which is a infection of the udder, they didn't necessarily know in technology to keep that out of the milk supply. Now we know that, and we know that. So now we know that we've been able to, you know, we're not allowed to sell that milk into the system. We have to actually dispose of it. So as we've gotten larger, we know that it now allows us to manage that better with the technology available to us. So we can actually a large dairy is probably safer than a small dairy nowadays.
And because it has to be a lot of people watching out for it, one thing. I was thinking when I was a kid working on the grandparents' farm, milk the cows into a bucket, carry the buckets across the barnyard full of crap everywhere, pour it into the separator, and we had milk. That was it. Not so much anymore, though.
Yeah, that's correct. Even when I grew up, we had to go milk the cows by hand before we went to school every morning. And we carried it in open buckets to the porch of the house, and we put it in a cream separator. Yeah. And then we put the cream in a can, and we sold. And a guy came along and picked it up and took it to the dairy. Yeah. Well, there was a lot of opportunity for exposure to bad bugs at that time. But yeah, we did it. And of course, back then they were testing for that. But now the testing and the handling of milk, you wouldn't be allowed today. In commercial dairy today, you wouldn't be allowed to have that milk exposed like that. So it's actually improved.
Yes. Well, let's go through some of the technologies that frighten us city people so and give you an opportunity to swat back at our fear, as it were, for which we're most grateful to have somebody to do that. Let's talk about organic. Why use poisons when you can be organic, Dennis Bulani?
Well, I'm that's just let me just state this, that organic farmers are trying to accomplish the same thing as commercial farmers. So let me be clear that I respect organic farmers, and they're trying to accomplish the same thing we are, but just in a different way. But just because you make your farm organic, does that mean there's a sign on the end of your field that keeps the bugs and weeds out? Certainly not. Certainly not. And a lot of people, since I've written the book, I was amazed to find out how many grocery shoppers believe that there's no pesticides or weed control products used in organic farming, when in fact there are. Because the regulations of organic are, you have to use a compound that Mother Nature makes. And actually, Mother Nature makes some pretty nasty compounds. If you use a compound Mother Nature makes, you can use it on an organic farm. And so the perception that organic food is safer is certainly not correct. It's certainly just as safe because of a regulation system, but it is no safer than commercial food because they use pesticides, as do we.
All right. And a lot of those pesticides that organic farmers use are in the plants themselves, when it gets right down to it.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. Spinosyn is an insecticide that organic farmers can use, and it is made by a bacteria in the soil naturally. Okay. So if it's made naturally, they can use it. Well, in commercial farming, we wouldn't use spinosyn because there's much better and actually safer insecticides that are synthetically made. Okay. So it seems to me that the regulations that organic farmers are supposed to follow are a little bit archaic because they're actually using some harsher pesticides in their cropping management than we are.
Now, but why don't you go organic and please all of those people like my wife who just buy organic and nothing else?
Well, I wouldn't convert to organic because I would go bankrupt. I say in my book that I'm not sure I've ever met a a wealthy organic farmer. If we went organic, we would not be allowed to use all the technology like GMO, genetically modified crops, like the new technological insecticides. And I would grow probably five times less food per acre. And if that was the case, I'd probably go bankrupt.
Some make it with organics, others don't. Why do they fail?
Well, I think a system has to be sustainable. And why do some organic farmers fail is because the weeds and insects beat them. Mother Nature is the force we're always fighting as farmers. And if you don't have all the tools available to you, then weeds, you know what it's like in your backyard. If you have a garden and there's weeds, it'll choke your carrots out and you won't grow any carrots. And those are the issues that organic farmers have to use. The biggest issue, I believe, with organic farming is if you mine the soil, and if you mine the soil and take nutrients out of the soil every year, eventually you'll deplete the soil. And they don't have the tools, i.e. synthetic fertilizers, to replace and replenish the soil. They can do it with cattle manure, but there's not enough cattle manure for the entire world to go organic. So that's really the issue.
Okay. And speaking of cattle manure, I would like to hear about cattle, because cattle have been running with people forever for the very simple reason that cattle can take something that's worth nothing and make something that's worth a whole bunch. And that is quite a story. So, ladies and gentlemen, you're tuned into the Food Chain Radio podcast. Michael Olson, your host for this hour, with Dennis Bellani, who is the author of About Food. Do stay tuned.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Port Ideas, Greg Williams.
There's a tremendous amount of useful information in MetroFarm for farming in or near the city.
Acres USA's Charles Walters.
MetroFarm tells how to convert an opportunity into a real going concern. Every chapter is organized around the logic of practicality. For every problem needing a solution, MetroFarm offers a progression of steps arranged in sequence so the desired goal is achieved.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org. The food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org. Farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place aboard the USS Dale during the opening moments, 7 December 1941.
As we left our berth and got underway, the deck force was still engaged in getting ready for combat. Fuller had the job of clearing the deck of all the wooden objects that had collected in port, so Fuller was making his way aft, just tossing stuff like a madman, when he came to the ice cream freeze. Before he could toss it over the side, one of the guys said, "Hey, wait a minute!" In a matter of seconds, the lock was broken and the ice cream distributed among the crew. So, what you saw that morning was the USS Dale steaming hell-bent out to the channel while the guys back aft were standing by their guns, eating ice cream and watching World War II break out all around.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
We are back on The Food Chain, Michael Olson, here with Dennis Bulani, the author of About Food, What a Farmer Wants You to Know About a Food. And there is so much we would like to know. One of the things that seemed to be increasingly problematic for city people is beef. Because of the flatulence and global warming and climate change and all of those things, we seem to be intent on getting rid of cattle for some reason. Your response?
Well, I think it's completely ridiculous that we would get rid of cattle. If we got rid of cattle, we would have so much food waste in the world that it would be unbelievable. You have to remember that when a grain farmer grows grain, sometimes the grain's not acceptable for human consumption. Sometimes the straw or fodder from grain production can be used to feed cattle. And so we actually are so sustainable that we use every piece of what we harvest. And we're able to do that because we have cattle. So we can feed any kind of cellulose to a cow and she'll convert it to high quality protein. To add to that, the majority of arable land in the world, or land that is agricultural, is land we couldn't cultivate and grow crops on. And nothing easier than a cow to walk halfway up a mountain, eat the grass up there, and convert the rays of sunlight from cellulose into high-quality protein. It would be actually devastating to the entire ag industry if we lost the cow, because she makes us so efficient at getting rid of crops that can't be used for human consumption.
And to use grasslands that would otherwise not be usable as well. So it's
yeah, and you know, we use grasslands with cattle, and there's no bigger person in the world than a cattleman as an environmentalist, because he takes care of the grass, he watches the grass, he doesn't overgraze it, he rotates his cows from paddock to paddock or pasture to pasture, and watches how those cows actually convert that cellulose into protein. And that's truly an amazing part of nature.
And something that we can certainly make use of. But what about all the flatulence and global warming?
Well, actually, if you look at that's a good point, because you have to understand that if you look at the bigger picture, at the cycle of life or the cycle of carbon, the flatulence is actually a part of the cycle of carbon, because the cow, think about it, eats the grass, and every time a cow defecates, it actually fertilizes that grassland. And yeah, flatulence can be a part of it, and it goes up into the atmosphere and eventually converts back into carbon, which comes back to the soil. So on a long period of time, it's actually quite a natural process. It's always interesting to me that people are concerned about cattle flatulence, and I know I have a dog, and the flatulence from all those dogs is certainly an issue. So people say to me sometimes, well, you get rid of your cows. And I say, okay, I'll get rid of my cows. But if you add up all the pets in the world, how about the pets? And by the way, we feed waste products to our pets that otherwise couldn't be utilized. And a big part of that is when we butcher cattle, the parts of the animal we can't eat get converted to pet food. So cattle really allow society to utilize every piece of what is taken from the land when we grow something, whether it's beef or grain.
There you go. One of the things I have come to believe is that I really think the big reason we don't like cattle is because we don't like the idea of taking an animal's life in order to eat it.
Yes, and that's true. And nobody will tell you more than anybody is that they call them livestock. I always say when you have livestock, you can have dead stock. the issue is that to supply protein to the world, I think God gave us the blessing of having cattle. And And he also gave it to us to eat and consume and nurture our bodies with the respect that if we kill them, that we kill them humanely and use and do it as humanely as possible, which we do.
There you go. Well, I guess the other one, the real big one that people has people quite frightened these days is genetically modified organisms, GMOs. What part do they play, and why are we so frightened of them?
I think we're frightened of them because we did a very poor job of explaining what GMOs were. Man's been breeding better varieties of plants and crops for millions of years. And we were doing it by selection. Go back 3,000 years ago, man was growing corn, and he said, well, why has one corn plant got a bigger cob on it than other corn plants? Well, they discovered if they seeded the seeds of that corn plant, they actually were selecting better genetics. And they were doing it randomly. With technology advancing the way it has, we can now do it specifically. So if we want a trait, in the old days, we would breed and breed and breed and look for the trait. With genetic modification, we can identify the actual gene that causes that trait and modify it so it gives us the trait we're looking for. And that might be drought resistance, weed resistance, and so on. So the interesting thing about genetic modification is we learned it from Mother Nature. A lot of people don't know this. Do you like sweet potatoes?
Especially sweet ones.
Yeah, everybody likes sweet potatoes. And a lot of people don't realize this, but we learned about genetic modification from Mother Nature. An organism that lives in the soil, an agrobacter-type organism, is a microorganism that actually, I don't know if you've walked through a forest, and every now and then you see a tree that has a gall on it or a swelling. Well, that's agrobacter at work. And what it does is it senses a cut on the side of a tree, and it goes to that cut, injects its DNA, modifies the tree to secrete sugar so it can live. Well, inadvertently, over time, just by the law of randomness, that bug transferred a gene from a sweet tuber plant into the potato, and as a result, we got the sweet potato. When we understood that that had happened in Mother Nature, we said, well, if Mother Nature can do it, let's use that same organism to help us inject a trait into a new variety that will be more healthy, a new variety that will allow us not to use so many pesticides in agriculture. And so we thought it was just an exciting advancement. You know, you go back to the 70s or when people said, we want you to use less pesticides. And farmers are always wanting to use less pesticides because we don't like spending money. So when this technology came about, we said, wow, just think about this. We can actually lower the pesticide load in the environment by using a genetically modified plant where, in fact, it protects itself naturally. And we learned all of that from the sweet potato or the agrobacter that created that.
And there it is. Well, let's go to the essential question that I posed to those biotechies at the McCormick Place in Chicago a few years ago. And I said to them, you know, your technology is absolutely spectacular. It's miraculous, as a matter of fact, that a farmer can now grow 1,000 acres of crops with no weeds or no bugs to contend with. And I've seen it a number of times, and it truly is a magnificent thing to comprehend, to be able to one person to do all of that, because he has the machinery and the chemicals and the technology to do it. So it is a wonderful, miraculous technology for agriculture. But what about us people who see that we're eating foods that have been essentially drenched in herbicides and infused with pesticides? Is it good for us too?
Okay, so I hear the word drenched, and we certainly do not drench anything with pesticides. First, let me be clear about that. Actually, if you take a 15-millimeter eyedropper and try and make a little one droplet of water with that, the amount of total pesticide I use on my farm would be maybe one-third of that droplet spread over a square foot. So just to give you a picture of the word drenched, that certainly isn't drenching.
Fair enough. Right? Well, okay, I say that because sometimes that's how we city people see things.
Yeah. And it creates a vision in my mind, at least. When somebody says the word drenched, it literally seems to me that these chemicals like literally running off my food, which is not the case. Actually, 80% of the time, maybe even 90% of the time, when we spray crop protection products, as I prefer to call them, we spray them when the seeds aren't even there yet. The majority is sprayed before we plant a crop, before a plant even sets seed. The majority of pesticides, over half of them, have been applied before the plant even does flowering. And so that's why we keep the load down. Now, the new technologies allowed us to cut our pesticide load probably almost in half over the last 40 years. And that's our goal to reduce the overall type of pesticide has something to do with it as well. There's safer ones and less safer ones. When we create a GMO crop or a new chemical even, It takes probably 15 years of research. So let's say you are a scientist and you create a new trait in a new plant. The government and the regulators would say, okay, you prove to us that new trait doesn't hurt humans. You have to do studies with animals, lab animals, and feed this and prove over and over and over again that it won't impact human health. There's 138 countries in the world that regulate this. So. And just think about it, 15 years of research from all over the world before that product can even be allowed to be sold into human consumption. So there is so much research and technology that's what gives me faith. The regulation system, the technology to create it, it gives me so much faith that at the end of the day, the food is safe. Now, in the U.S., you guys think that the whole world revolves around what some senator did with a lobby group. That's not the case. All products, genetically modified, new chemicals, go through probably 138 countries in the world. So if they're safe in England or Canada, they're probably also then therefore safe in the USA. But every country does this research. And that's what's exciting to me. And that's what gives me the confidence of how safe our food is. Because of our regulation system that makes sure that if I develop a new technology, it is tested and proven to all the protocols, not just one time, but probably 95% of the time, to give us a degree of confidence that it's safe for the human population.
Well, Dennis, you're doing a pretty good job of standing up and speaking out for the convention or the contemporary technologies of agriculture that can be used to make great big strides in productivity across the land. How can you convince? What is it going to take to convince most of the people, 76% of the people, that food is actually safe? Is it, you're going to need some help.
Yes, I do. And that's why I wrote the book, What a Farmer Wants You to Know About Food. If you are a consumer and you have those questions, here's what we can do together. Buy my book. Get it. You can get it from Amazon online. Read the book and then get a hold of me through trustyourplate.com. If you have any more questions, I've had people read this book and say, oh, wow, this book has 100 more references than there are pages in the book. So if I said something in the book, it's backed up by a lot of peer-reviewed other sources. And I want it to be correct, not just my opinion. And once you read the book, I've had a lot of people that have read the book and said, you know what, I do feel a lot better about the food system. Are there serious questions? Yes. What are those questions? And my suggestion is, If farmers would use my book as a tool to help answer the questions when they're asked, their voice is well received. And if farmers take the book and give it to their friends in the city, then eventually I believe the consumers of the world will will have a better understanding of how complicated and how safe our food system really is as a result of science, research, and critical thinking. Critical thinking, to me, is the biggest piece. If you're a consumer, please be a critical thinker. Ask why. Ask why over and over again. And a lot of people say, I know I heard a remark the other day, a person said to me, well, the cancer rates are going up. And I said, well, which cancer rates? And are they in fact going up? And where did you get the data from? I'm always asking why. Did it or didn't it?
What do you say to those people who say, I'm tired of being a critical thinker. I just want to buy food that's safe.
That's right. And I equate that to getting on a jetliner and going for an airline flight, a public airline flight.
You got to have some trust.
You're going to have to trust us. Whether you like it or not, the farmers are the keepers of the gate. And as a farmer, I've asked all the same questions. So can you trust the keeper of the gate? Yes. Should you ask and check in once a year or twice a year and ask me how it's going? Absolutely, because you're our customer.
Dennis Bulani, thank you so much for joining us. Dennis, the farmer up there in Saskatchewan and the author of About Food, What a Farmer Wants You to Know. And we should all know it. So stay tuned very much. And Dennis, thank you for joining us today. It's been a great adventure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here. And I look forward to hearing some comments on TrustYourPlate.com.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.